This is Agriculture Today.
I think we might be getting to the point to where people are throwing in the towel and just saying, hey, I got to rebuild the herd at some point. Let's just start doing it now. So I think if we can continue to see the U.S. cattle producer rebuilding that herd over the long term, we'll see some feed demand come back.
Cody Gerlach is Director of Strategic Sales with Barchard.
For me personally, I'm focused on rebuilding the herd because I think that's where the opportunities are going to be over the next few years.
The fact that we haven't been rebuilding the herd means our cattle numbers are down, which means more pressure on packers. But a labor dispute at one of the nation's largest beef processing facilities now continues into another week. It raises concerns about potential impacts on production and the broader cattle market. Nearly 3,800 workers at a JBS-owned Swift Beef Plant in Greeley, Colorado, remain on strike as negotiations between the company and union representatives have stalled. Strike began March 16, centers on allegations of unfair labor practices, wage concerns, and workplace conditions. Of course, the situation comes at a time when the beef sector already navigating tight cattle supplies and strong demand, which makes any disruption to processing more significant for the supply chain. Well, U.S. soybean transportation costs declined late last year, but the improvement is not translating into stronger export performance. USDA data shows lower truck and barge rates did help reduce total transportation cost for U.S. soybeans during the fourth quarter. It's easing some pressure on export competitiveness. However, rising ocean freight rates offset part of those gains, limiting the overall impact on landed cost. At the same time, Brazil's seen sharply higher transportation costs, especially for trucking, yet continue to expand its dominance in global soybean trade. Brazil exported 12.8 million metric tons of soybeans to China during the fourth quarter, up significantly from the previous year. U.S. exports, however, dropped to just 1.44 million metric tons. Well, grain transportation shifting into spring mode as the Mississippi River system reopens, while rising diesel prices expected to push freight costs higher in the weeks ahead. Mid-Mississippi River reopened for navigation on the 19th, followed by the Upper Mississippi, reaching St. Paul on March 24th. It marked the final season opening point. Reopening now comes slightly later than last year, but it does restore a key export corridor after winter closures. Last year, more than 12.8 million metric tons of grain moved through a key lower Mississippi lock. It underscores the system's importance to U.S. exports. Transportation costs now becoming a growing concern. Diesel prices surging to over $5.37 per gallon, up sharply in recent weeks, which will begin flowing into railcar shipping cost through higher fuel surcharges starting in the month of May. And for long-distance routes, that could add roughly $575 per rail car to freight cost. Shippers already reacting. Rail demand expected to increase this month. It's Agriculture Today.
Manage your risk and take advantage of opportunities with StoneX. Utilizing StoneX's global presence to provide the best in market intelligence, a vast portfolio of risk management and marketing products, and a team of brokers who specialize in working with those in agriculture, StoneX provides the resources you need to make the best possible decisions. Learn more about the StoneX Advantage. Call Donna Hughes at 214-613-1688. There's substantial risk to futures and options trading. Not all products are suitable for all producers.
Purple Wave Auction remains the trusted leader in online equipment auctions. What makes the difference is you. You are part of our growing global community that continues to trust Purple Wave with the equipment that builds and feeds America. This trust placed in us by our community, from construction to ag producers and fleet drivers, brings great equipment opportunities to their next owners. Join the Purple Wave community today. PurpleWave.com.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Since 2023, canola oil and soy oil combined accounted for over 30% of the feedstocks used to produce biomass-based diesel, including renewable diesel.
Bree Botts is a grain and oilseed analyst with Terrain.
Based on actual soy oil feedstock used from Q1 2025 to Q3 2025, the lost soybean utilization would be nearly 45 million bushels annually. These state-level policies may constrain the role of soy oil in key domestic markets and influence renewable diesel production decisions, particularly where feedstock flexibility is limited. Additionally, the current state programs will undermine the federal incentives unless the indirect land use change penalty is removed from states' carbon emission calculator for crop-based feedstocks, and imports are removed from LCFS eligibility. The paradox is that the soy oil market is both buoyed and capped by California biofuel policy. Strong soy oil demand can improve crusher margins, which increases the crush pace. Greater domestic demand for crushed soybeans could partially offset the long-term lower export demand. Terrain projects China's slowing economic growth and Brazil's stronger global competition will curtail foreign demand for soybeans longer term. This implies that soybean future prices may not radically shift, but farmers are likely to see stronger or narrower basis and more favorable pricing optionality. The biggest winners will be farmers who are located near both soybean crush plants and renewable diesel plants that rely on soy oil from those local crush plants as their primary feedstock. The benefits of the new federal 45Z tax credit are not likely to materialize until the later half of 2026 or early 2027 because of the regulatory thresholds needed. Additionally, the tax credit goes to the biofuel producer, not the farmer. So engaging with local buyers is critical for farmers interested in participating in USDA's proposed climate smart agriculture practices. However, these benefits are only realized with further biofuel policy clarity. Without more clarity, renewable diesel production is at risk, and domestic soybean crushers could reduce their pace if margins get squeezed. The USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service reported soy oil on hand at the end of the month at 1.7 billion pounds in December 2025, a 44% increase from December 2024, highlighting the concern of future soy oil utilization when policy doesn't reinforce demand for domestic crop-based feedstock. Continued delays in policy will linger in the first half of 2026, causing these headwinds to persist in the short term. Additionally, the misalignment between federal incentives and state programs will continue to limit soy oil's upside potential in the largest U.S. consumption markets. The ability of soy oil and indirectly soybeans to regain lost feedstock market share will depend heavily on the EPA finalizing 2026 and 2027 RVOs, RIN credits for import versus domestic, and SREs, past and future policy. The USDA releasing the new 45Z CI calculator outlining on-farm sustainability practices and the associated CI scores and addressing the verification and record-keeping requirements and whether conflicting carbon policies in LCFS-driven states can be addressed. Until then, they will continue to favor imported feedstocks. The outcome of these decisions will determine where soy oil use falls in feedstock priority and will influence future crush demand for U.S. soybeans. For U.S. farmers, a stable tax credit policy provides biofuel stakeholders and soybean crushers the clarity to support consistent year-round demand for soybeans, which results in higher basis, improved pricing opportunities, and sustained long-term profitability. If federal and state policies move toward alignment and prioritize domestic feedstocks, the U.S. is positioned for stronger crush demand in the latter half of 2026 and beyond. Without that clarity, the industry risks the continuation of 2025 stagnation.
It's Agriculture Today.
Introducing the heavyweight champion of the livestock operation, Case IH Farmall Utility Series Tractors.
Farmall Utility Tractors don't just outweigh the competition. They're engineered to distribute weight where it works, from the transmission, central housing, and axles to the differentials and final drives. So add some weight to your operation and go the distance with Farmall Utility Tractors.
I'm Scott Wiley. We'll try hard to earn your business, but even harder to keep it. That's it. That's all.
This has been Scott Land Company in Dimmitt, Texas. We have literally sold thousands of acres of grassland in Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, and Oklahoma. Our inventory on ranches is as low as it has been in years. We really need listings on ranches of all sizes. Look at our website, scottlandcompany.com. Give us a call at 800-933-9698.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Mexico is one of those partner areas.
Shauna Morris is Vice President of Trade Policy with the National Milk Producers Federation.
All told, we have a bit less than a dozen across Latin America, Europe, and Asia. And really, those partnerships are aimed at identifying where do we have common ground and how do we make sure that we're focusing on those areas to work together in a productive way. So some of the topics include things like rejecting anti-dairy proposals. Now, especially at the multilateral level, there's lots of folks that think they know the answers and it doesn't involve dairy consumption in terms of what people should be eating for all host of different reasons. Or on the dairy nomenclature debate, you know, what should be able to be called cheese or milk, et cetera. We also partner through a lot of those arrangements on dairy consumption issues from a recognition that if in that trading partner's market, more people are consuming dairy products. Well, that's not just good for them. It's good for us. How do we collaborate to help drive that upward momentum in terms of dairy consumption habits? And then some in the trade space too. For instance, a number of them are focused on working to protect open markets for cheeses, to make sure that we're protecting the ability to sell common cheese name products, pushing back against the EU's geographical indication agenda that wants to stamp out competition. Again, that helps them, their domestic production and their markets, certainly helps us from the export side. We use these time and time again in Mexico, leaning on our partners there when anti-trade and protectionist proposals are trying to prop up. And we've relied really heavily on it as well, for instance, in Colombia, just a couple years ago when there was a case moving through pushed by the government in Colombia to try to put new tariffs in place, alleging that our dairy products were being unfairly subsidized, our milk powder exports to Colombia. And so we used that partnership we had with one of their groups there to both push back with coordinated messaging and tell the truth about what was actually going on.
Talks about other dairy trade policy details.
There's a host of different issues. Frankly, our goal is always to be trying to the fullest extent possible to be tackling those issues, working together with a lot of our regulatory colleagues on the Dairy Export Council side, to head them off before they get implemented. Sometimes some of them do, though. So for instance, right now, our exporters aren't able to ship to Turkey, and they've changed some of their regulatory requirements for imports. We're trying to work with the administration to reopen access to that market. Elsewhere in that neighborhood, we're doing a lot of work trying to preemptively weigh in at an early stage of the process as the EU is looking at what do they want to do on animal welfare and how much of that should be applied to imported products. EU isn't a huge market for us, but we certainly ship a fair amount. We also ship product to other markets that winds its way to the EU at the end of the day, so it needs to be EU eligible. And we certainly don't want EU bureaucrats dictating to our farmers what proper animal welfare looks like, particularly for an industry that has such high standards the way we do under the Farm Animal Care Program. So working to weigh in with EU policymakers as they're trying to put those regulations together at an early stage has been a big focus to try to avoid future trade barriers from coming down the pipe. On a little bit more positive side, we've also been doing a fair amount of work with Indonesia, partnering there with some of their industry, looking to try to encourage greater use of dairy as Indonesia has been rolling into effect over the past year, a new school meals program that includes school milk. We want to make sure that we're maximizing the amount of kids that actually have access to milk under that program through a combination of helping support their local production and, of course, complementary imported product, too.
It's Agriculture Today.
Let's talk about supply chains. Each year, Cotton Incorporated's global supply chain marketing team has hundreds of meetings with brands and retailers in all corners of the globe. They're working to find innovative ways to replace synthetic fabrics with natural, sustainable cotton to expand your customer base and drive more demand. You grow the cotton. The Cotton Research and Promotion Program helps grow the value. Learn more at cottonboard.org.
If you're going to succeed, you need cotton that's strong enough to perform around here where you grow. That's why Delta Pine cotton varieties are bred to meet the needs of your neck of the woods and are rigorously evaluated by local growers for maximum performance potential and consistency year after year. Strong cotton performance starts round here with locally tested Delta Pine cotton. Learn more at deltapine.com. Read and follow pesticide label directions, grain marketing, and other stewardship practices.
This is Agriculture Today.
I would say this year and 2022 are prime examples of the need for a plan.
Mike Castle is Lead Market Intelligence Program Director for StoneX, taking a look at how producers can insulate themselves.
Fertilizer and, you know, inputs more broadly are kind of these markets that we've typically ignored, right? Everyone has a grain marketing plan, or at minimum pays attention to the grain prices on a daily basis. It's time to start doing this on fertilizer too. And if you look back, fertilizer prices didn't used to be that volatile. It was a market you could kind of ignore, and a lot of folks did, right? They basically just show up when you need it, and you can assume it's going to be there. But one thing I think is important to point out to the farmer is that you're not the only one who's now subject to this volatility. So is your supplier. So the number one piece of advice I can give is have those conversations with your suppliers earlier than you think you need to, and more often, bug them. Because at the end of the day, they can't just go get long all this stuff and hope that demand shows up, right? They're subject to that same volatility. They're seeing major price swings as well. And part of that is, you know, something we probably don't have time to dive into, but as the U.S. becomes a more important player in the export market, we're just running on naturally tighter inventories. And what that means is when you see a shock like this, if you don't have that buffer supply built up, because we're competing more directly with the export market, all of a sudden you see a lot more volatility. You see a lot more violent inland price swings. So, you know, the folks who had their stuff booked in advance this year or who applied anhydrous in the fall, they could just go ahead and pat themselves on the back at this point. But if you were waiting till the last minute, what we saw a lot this year was the folks who would normally apply P&K in the fall say, well, maybe I'll kick the can down the road. They didn't like affordability, and for good reason. It was bad. Again, no need to sugarcoat that. But now it's significantly worse. And phosphate is a market where we're actually more exposed to the strait. So I think that's going to be something that becomes an even bigger issue moving forward here this spring. But you know, fertilizer is still a very immature market. We're trying our best to kind of move it forward. It does still feel decades behind the grain market, but hopefully this shock and, you know, obviously having the second one of these in the last 4 years can kind of act as a catalyst to help that maturity to kind of push it forward. And we have seen the CME. They now have a 10-ton more farmer-sized urea contract. Hopefully we can kind of continue to see products, you know, actual tradable products, allow us to generate better risk management plans for not just the grain, but also the fertilizer. And a final note on that, I really like pushing, and anyone who follows our stuff has probably seen this before, what we call our fertilizer grain ratios. Basically, you know, I started my career as a merchandiser buying grain from farmers. I know that grain prices are never high enough. I've been working on the fertilizer side for several years. Fertilizer prices are never low enough, right? Take the sticker shock out of them. Just look at the two in relation to one another. Look at the relationship of the input versus the output, because at the end of the day, that's what matters for affordability. So instead of treating these as two separate markets, I think something that's really smart is to, when you find that buying opportunity, if you can follow this from a ratio perspective and identify a good buying opportunity, or just, hey, affordability looks good right now, or much better than it should at this time of year typically, sell the grain, buy the fertilizer at the same time, lock in that relationship instead of having to try and pick the high in grain and the low in fertilizer. Think about the two together.
And this is Agriculture Today.
Manage your risk and take advantage of opportunities with StoneX. Utilizing StoneX's global presence to provide the best in market intelligence, a vast portfolio of risk management and marketing products, and a team of brokers who specialize in working with those in agriculture, StoneX provides the resources you need to make the best possible decisions. Learn more about the StoneX Advantage. Call Donna Hughes at 214-613-1688.
There's substantial risk to futures and options trading. Not all products are suitable for all producers.
Purple Wave Auction remains the trusted leader in online equipment auctions. What makes the difference is you. You are part of our growing global community that continues to trust Purple Wave with the equipment that builds and feeds America. This trust placed in us by our community, from construction to ag producers and fleet drivers, brings great equipment opportunities to their next owners. Join the Purple Wave community today. PurpleWave.com.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Biofuels, especially renewable diesel, have become a major driver of U.S. soybean oil demand.
Bree Botts is a grain and oilseed analyst with Terrain.
Renewable diesel stands out for its chemical similarities to petroleum-based diesel and ability to replace fossil diesel one for one, unlike biodiesel, which requires additional blending. This makes it an ideal candidate for use by large states that involve heavy transportation and a win for the farmers who grow crops for the feedstocks, especially soybeans. Renewable diesel can be produced from several types of oil and fat feedstocks, including soy oil, canola oil, corn oil, animal fat like tallow, and used cooking oil, or UCO. Each feedstock is measured by a carbon intensity, or CI score, based on its life cycle and or other non-biofuel uses. With the support of their credit mandate systems, West Coast states, led by California, are the primary consumers of renewable diesel. Between 2022 and 2024, renewable diesel consumption almost doubled before collapsing in 2025 because of uncertainty around federal biofuel tax credits, feedstocks, and producer eligibility. The switch from a blender's to producer's tax credit, along with the lack of guidance from the Treasury and IRS, has caused widespread disruption to renewable diesel production. In 2025, production declined 10% from 2024, according to the EIA, causing plants to idle capacity. Fortunately, biofuel policies should become somewhat clearer in 2026. The EPA is expected to issue final renewable volume obligations, or RVOs, in the coming weeks, including clarification on whether imported fuels and feedstocks receive a 50% RIN, Renewable Identification Number credit, tied to biofuel production. More clarity is also expected on the treatment of past and future small refinery exemptions, or SRE waivers, that have historically reduced overall volume blend obligations. With more clarity expected around biofuel policy, the EIA forecasts a recovery in renewable diesel production and consumption in 2026, followed by growth in 2027, with nearly 90% capacity utilization versus less than 60% forecast in 2025. The lack of federal guidance around biofuel policy has also limited domestic feedstock demand and limited future soybean crush capacity expansion. While stronger demand for feedstocks and renewable diesel production is anticipated later in 2026, logistics and geography will continue to play a significant role in purchase decisions between biofuel feedstocks. Over 80% of current renewable diesel capacity in the U.S. is located near ports, with easy access to imported waste fats, UCO from China, tallow from Brazil, and imported canola oil via Vancouver. While UCO and tallow have favorable CI scores and higher associated tax credits, the renewable diesel plants must also have pretreatment abilities to utilize these types of feedstocks. I estimate that over 70% of renewable diesel capacity is located at favorable port access and has pretreatment abilities, and therefore will continue to use a combination of soy oil and non-soy oil feedstocks. The remaining 20% of renewable diesel capacity is spread out across the western two-thirds of the U.S. and Canada in landlocked regions. These facilities are less likely to use imported feedstocks. Importantly, facilities without pretreatment ability will likely depend on heavy vegetable oil, including soy oil, feedstocks, as their primary source for renewable diesel. Of existing U.S. capacity, only 12% of facilities are set up to use vegetable oil, with the remaining 88% able to continue to use beef tallow, UCO, corn oil, and other feedstocks.
It's Agriculture Today.
Introducing the heavyweight champion of the livestock operation, Case IH Farmall Utility Series Tractors.
Farmall Utility Tractors don't just outweigh the competition. They're engineered to distribute weight where it works, from the transmission, central housing, and axles to the differentials and final drives. So add some weight to your operation and go the distance with Farmall Utility Tractors.
I'm Scott Wiley. We'll try hard to earn your business, but even harder to keep it. That's it. That's all.
This has been Scott, Scott Land Company in Dimmitt, Texas. We have literally sold thousands of acres of grassland in Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, and Oklahoma. Our inventory on ranches is as low as it has been in years. We really need listings on ranches of all sizes. Look at our website, scottlandcompany.com. Give us a call at 800-933-9698.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The National Pork Producers Council Board of Directors attended the White House Celebration of Agriculture, where the President recognized the efforts of America's farmers and shone a spotlight on those who produce the nation's food, fiber, and fuel. Trump twice in the past week, once in a Truth Social post, and again at the White House event, urged Congress to pass a farm bill. Earlier that week, Iowa pork producer and NPPC President Rob Brenneman took part in a National Agriculture Day producer panel hosted by the National Agri-Marketing Association at USDA headquarters. While there, Brenneman spoke with RFD Radio about pork's needs and visited with Deputy Secretary of Agriculture Stephen Vaden, who's been a fierce advocate in the fight against California's Proposition 12. In preparation for the Farm Bill 2.0 passage, Brenneman and NPPC board members spent time on Capitol Hill, meeting with House and Senate offices and committees on both sides of the aisle. They also advocated for renewal of the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, a year-round solution to the H-2A visa program, and appropriations requests that would benefit pork producers. In other news on the update, the U.S. agriculture industry grew by almost $900 billion over the past year. That's according to an economic impact study led each year by the Corn Refiners Association and sponsored by three dozen agriculture and food organizations, including NPPC. The 2026 Food and Agriculture Industries Economic Impact Study report showed the American food industry, farmers, ranchers, processors, manufacturers, wholesalers, retailers, and indirect businesses like suppliers and transporters supported almost 49 million jobs and generated more than $10 million in economic activity, accounting for almost 20% of total U.S. economic output. The 10th annual Feeding the Economy report includes a state-by-state breakdown of agriculture's economic impact, showing total jobs, wages, output, taxes, and exports, and key findings include food and agriculture generated more than $3 trillion in wages for U.S. workers, with wages rising 4% year over year and 13% over the past decade. Food manufacturing remains the largest manufacturing sector in the United States, employing almost 2.3 million workers. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative submitted to the World Trade Organization additional comments on reforms to the international trade body. USTR's follow-up to a December 2025 report to the WTO was transmitted a month after the U.S. Agriculture Coalition for WTO Reform, of which NPPC is a member, sent a list of recommended WTO improvements to the U.S. Trade Agency. Talks on reforming the 30-year-old WTO started during the first term of President Trump. It's been critical of some aspects of the trade organization. Among other suggestions, USTR recommended that the WTO level the international trade playing field by significantly strengthening incentives to comply with existing obligations to submit notifications of trade rules, restore the purpose of the special and differential treatment provision by agreeing to objective criteria for determining a country's eligibility for it, and rethink how the most favored nation principle functions in its current form, and begin discussions on the link between MFN and reciprocity, a bedrock WTO founding principle. Chad Smith, Washington.
Let's talk about supply chains. Each year, Cotton Incorporated's global supply chain marketing team has hundreds of meetings with brands and retailers in all corners of the globe. They're working to find innovative ways to replace synthetic fabrics with natural, sustainable cotton to expand your customer base and drive more demand. You grow the cotton. The Cotton Research and Promotion Program helps grow the value. Learn more at cottonboard.org.
If you're going to succeed, you need cotton that's strong enough to perform around here where you grow. That's why Delta Pine cotton varieties are bred to meet the needs of your neck of the woods and are rigorously evaluated by local growers for maximum performance potential and consistency year after year. Strong cotton performance starts around here with locally tested Delta Pine cotton. Learn more at DeltaPine.com. Read and follow pesticide label directions, grain marketing, and other stewardship practices.